Good afternoon. Why do some of us say yes to school taxes while others say no? This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. School funding measures, they tend to sail right through. In Seattle, not so across the lake, where Lake Washington School District is trying to pass a bond measure for the third time. Here's KUOW's education reporter, Ann Dornfeld.
Students are lining up for lunch at Margaret Mead Elementary in Sammamish. If you're imagining them in the cafeteria, think again. This lunch line is outside in the school courtyard.
As you can see here, because it's a delicious salad bar, it's very attractive to our neighborhood crows and other little animals and birds. So we've had to put a crow net just because keeping the crows out was almost impossible.
Principal Sandy Klein says students eat in their classrooms because this overcrowded school has no cafeteria, and the gym is constantly in use by PE classes. It's just one of the many compromises the school makes to find space for all of these little bodies. Lake Washington School District includes nearly 28,000 students in Redmond, Kirkland, and parts of Sammamish and Bellevue. The number of students has grown by 15% in just the past few years.
We want to provide our students with the learning environments and classroom space that they deserve.
Superintendent Tracy Pierce says the district's nearly $400 million bond proposal is critical in order to make room for the huge influx of kids. It would pay for three new schools and rebuild three more, including Mead Elementary, which would get its cafeteria.
Through this bond measure, we'll be able to create space for 3,000 students.
Pierce is hopeful that voters will be more enthusiastic about this plan than they were the last two times the district tried to pass bond measures. Efforts in 2010 and 2014 came just shy of the 60% supermajority needed to pass a bond measure in this state. So why did Lake Washington fail to pass its school bonds when Seattle easily passes its measures? Voters on the east side tend to be more conservative. Many considered the last bond measures to be extravagant. Pierce says another important difference is the background of many of the new families in the area.
We've got high-tech companies in our area that attract people from all over the world, and so that makes us a bit unique as well. We do have a significant number of our parents who are not able to vote. They pay property tax. They would like to be able to vote, but they're not citizens.
In 2014, this district had nearly twice as many non-citizens of voting age as Seattle did. So this year, the district is going to voters with a much smaller bond proposal. Unlike past measures, this one would not increase the tax rate because it would replace expiring bonds. But Susan Wilkins is not impressed.
The idea that 60% of this will go to tearing down three schools and then rebuilding them that will add not a lot of space for the students is poorly thought out.
Wilkins has had four children in the district and sat on the task force to plan the latest bond.
What we really need to do is analyze how many new schools we need to hold all of the students who are arriving, and then build those schools. And after that, then it would make a lot of sense to remodel if funding is available.
The district says this proposal is the most cost-effective way to increase space for the time being, but there will still be portables at many schools. In order to make room for the ever-growing student population, more bond measures are already planned in 2018 and 2022. And 2026. In Redmond, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
So that's the struggle to raise money in the Lake Washington School District. And you're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. We're going to talk about Bellevue High School and an investigation that has found rule-breaking when it comes to recruiting athletes in the premier football program in Washington State. That's coming up in about 7 minutes. Thanks for tuning in to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Last week, a small group of Boeing employees traveled to Tehran to start talks that could bring in huge sales.
There are very few unicorn markets, if you will, in aerospace left in the world.
Unicorn markets. That's John Ostrower, aerospace reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And the unicorn market he's talking about is the country of Iran. The aerospace market there has been untouched for decades because of political sanctions. Now Iranian officials want to replace and grow their decrepit airplane fleets. But there's a complication. one of Boeing's biggest current clients, could be its biggest obstacle to getting Iran's business, as John Ostrower told KUOW's Kim Malcolm.
The U.S. Defense Department is the single largest customer for Boeing. So, you know, when you connect that to the fierce Republican opposition to the Iran deal in the Congress and as it, you know, taking center stage in the 2016 presidential election, there is a sort of a tightrope that Boeing has to walk as far as how it works within U.S. policy as of right now and taking their cues from the State Department and the Treasury Department about what conversations they can have and within what bounds they can begin to negotiate deals. So that's sort of the tightrope that they have to walk and ultimately staying as close to and not even an inch ahead of U.S. policy.
And so how can Boeing negotiate those pitfalls potentially facing them?
Well, a lot of it is going to be stepping back and letting U.S. policy do a lot of the initial guidance, you know, really asking for permission rather than forgiveness to not, you know, kind of run out ahead and make deals when the diplomatic and economic structures for these kind of discussions isn't fully fleshed out. So they're going to be looking for a lot of guidance from the Obama administration about where they can and can't tread here. And even the list of airlines that Boeing can even talk to is actually highly, highly restricted. And actually the number two airline in Iran has been linked to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and is designated by the Treasury Department as a sponsor of terror. So there is certainly restrictions within the restrictions just to even have a conversation. So, you know, certainly at this point, what Boeing does have there is a license to have these conversations, to flesh out deals with Iranian airlines, understand what they need, and present offers to them. The offers can be signed, and that is that, you know, the deals can be firmed up. The next time we're going to see the U.S. get involved is actually around delivery, and there's a required sort of approval process for actually having State and Treasury sign off on actually handing over these aircraft to the Iranians. So you've got a lot of moving parts here, but the overarching idea is that if Boeing can successfully sell billions of dollars worth of jetliners to Iranian airlines, it is a significant test case for U.S. businesses who also want to do open up previously untapped markets. Whether it's GE, whether it's other industrial equipment that is now kind of loosening with the lifting of the sanctions.
What do we know about Boeing's discussions with Iran at this point?
At this point, there's only been a very small series of meetings that began just last week, and it's a small team, about fewer than 10 Boeing employees made the trip to begin these conversations. And a lot of these meetings just consist of talking to a select group of airlines about, okay, what do you need? What is your fleet now? How can the slate of aircraft that Boeing offers essentially line up with what you need to replace in your fleet and what you need to be hopefully growing for the future? So a lot of it is talking turkey. You know, they're sitting around talking shop and trying to understand what the needs are.
The airline industry has been doing pretty well over the last decade or so, but some people are saying that can't last for too much longer. So what would a deal with Iran do for Boeing's longevity?
Well, it certainly extends the rally just a little bit longer. There have been analysts who have suggested that, you know, and as far as the commercial aircraft cycle, and the notoriously cyclical commercial aircraft cycle, is, you know, already in extra innings. You know, the question really is, how many extra innings do we get? Certainly, any deal for several hundred aircraft for Iran, for either Boeing, Airbus, or others, would stretch that out and just give a bit more cushion in sort of the slate of orders that do, you know, when economic times change or there is a sort of external event, whether it's SARS or 9/11 or some very big external shock, where that demand for air traffic would fall, and the orders that are associated with the airlines who want to grow and replace their fleets would effectively burn off. So this just provides an additional cushion for sure. And certainly from a combination of replacement of the existing very old fleet, that need remains there. Certainly any tightening of financial markets or access to capital to actually pay for these airplanes, which could be as much a political question as it is a global financial one, really is sort of questionable should the jetliner market take a downturn.
John Ostrower, aerospace reporter for The Wall Street Journal, talking with Kim Malcolm. Boeing's biggest competitor, Airbus, has already signed an agreement for an order of 118 new aircrafts for Iran, still just a fraction of the planes that that country needs. We're going to talk about ground transportation in a few minutes here. What can Seattle learn about light rail of the future by looking at its past? That's coming up in about 10 minutes. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The state's powerhouse high school football program is in trouble. State athletics investigators say the Bellevue High School Wolverines participated in a scheme to recruit out-of-district players. Mike Baker reported this story for the Seattle Times, and first he told me just how big Bellevue High School football is.
Bellevue High School has just really been the most dominant team in the state for more than a decade now. I mean, there was a period in recent years they had a 67-game winning streak. At one point they were ranked as the number one team nationally. I mean, it's sort of like people around here might only think of Texas high school football as having some of the big names. Well, this is sort of the closest thing that we have up here to Texas high school football.
And what has this investigation found? What kind of rule-breaking happened around Bellevue High School football?
So the investigations looked at sort of a series of issues and said, you know, saying that they have evidence that boosters paid for athletes to attend this alternative private school, that coaches were encouraging players to go to this private school, that false addresses were used to help players gain eligibility. So those are sort of like the big headline items from how they're describing the report so far.
And the finger points at the boosters, this sort of informal group that chips in money to augment the football program?
Right. Certainly the boosters paying the tuition is one of the bigger issues. But they also pointed the coaches as having played a role in directing athletes to attend this private school. So it seems like a combination of both coaches and boosters.
This private alternative school, will you explain this school in an office park?
Right, yeah, it's called the Academic Institute. It's had about 40 students. And we found that there were 17 Bellevue football players who had attended Academic Institute in recent years. And, yeah, it's a really small school. It's in this office park. It's a private alternative school. And they don't have a football team. So if you're a player that goes there, you can actually still go and play football at your nearby public school, and that's Bellevue High.
And some students used addresses in Bellevue, even though they didn't actually live in Bellevue. The Booster Club says, yeah, we gave money to this little school, the Academic Institute. We give money to all kinds of community organizations. They're saying that there's no wrongdoing here. Can they appeal the state's investigation? Is this the final say-so?
Yeah, I think it's. I think for a lot of folks, that they're waiting to see what the actual report found. So right now, they've basically described a summary of the report. We don't have the evidence. We don't have sort of all the interviews and findings from the report yet. I think there's going to be a discussion after that once it's all laid out, whether the evidence supports the conclusions and, you know, how whether there's going to be any sanctions proposed by the school or the school district. Once all that comes out, I think it'll be an interesting discussion for sure.
It's not just boosters. Coaches might be implicated in this. What kind of punishment could Bellevue High School football face?
You know, there's really a huge range of punishments out there. You know, when we were reporting several years ago on the Chief South women's basketball team, and they had a bunch of issues related to illegal recruiting, they ended up getting stripped of a couple of their state titles. So that's sort of the higher end of the punishments. And, you know, on the lower end, you have something like a probation or sort of lower end sanction.
We're talking with Mike Baker here, who's been reporting this story for the Seattle Times. How could the state's rulemaking body that governs high school sports, how could they have not known about this for years?
Well, for the governing body, they're really a league-driven organization. So they're not out there taking in tips and then chasing down and start initiating their own investigations. So, for example, in this case, you know, the school district only asked the WIAA to investigate, the sort of the governing body to investigate the school after we reported the story last year. So it's really the governing body sort of waits for cues from the schools, their member schools and the districts. You know, we've heard rumors about Bellevue for years. I think the problem has always been is that no one has an evidence or a piece of paper or proof. They might not even have names of what the players are. So it's really difficult to discern what sort of rumor and legend and theory that has been around and is being spread by people who might be jealous of the Bellevue football program or have an axe to grind or have, you know, have some other motivation for bringing the issue up. So, you know, in this case, it might be, you know, why didn't other schools in the area call for investigations? There's a number of competitor teams in Bellevue's conference that could have raised the issue to the surface or pushed it further, you know, in past years.
It's a good question. Why didn't other schools getting licked on the field year after year, why didn't they call for an investigation?
You know, it's interesting, and a lot of the schools don't really want to talk about Bellevue, and we've tried to interview a number of them, a number of the coaches and the administrators there, and, you know, yeah, a lot of them just don't have a lot of interest in talking about any concerns that they've had over the years.
Mike, how have Bellevue High School officials and boosters and parents reacted to your and the Seattle Times reporting on this?
It's really been a mix. We've certainly got a lot of Bellevue supporters who think the reporting has been unfair or that the investigation has been unfair. On the other hand, I also hear from a lot of people, not just competitors of Bellevue, but people who are in the Bellevue High School community who have called and expressed praise and thanks that this is finally coming to light, that, you know, they've witnessed issues for years and have been frustrated by it. So it's certainly an ongoing conversation in that community, and actually just gotten notice that the Bellevue Booster Club is, you know, encouraging people tomorrow to come out to the school board. There's a school board meeting tomorrow afternoon. They're urging people to come out and pack the house there to have, you know, sort of like continue that conversation. It'll be an interesting one for sure.
I don't suppose you're going to be at that school board meeting.
I'll be there.
Yeah. Okay. Will you tell us about it?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. We'll be glad to be back on.
Mike Baker, Seattle Times. Thanks for telling us about this and reporting on it.
Hey, thank you guys.
Now, the Bellevue High School Booster Club says in a statement it has not seen this investigation's report, but the club strongly disagrees that it violated any rules. And the group says investigators have shown extraordinary bias. Now, Mike Baker and I discussed there why some people don't reveal their concerns about public school sports. What story do you want to tell us about high school athletics? Maybe you're part of the Bellevue Wolverines family or another program. What does high school sports look like from your seat? Let us know. We are live tweeting the show right now at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Sound Transit wants to know what you think. They're taking public comment on the plan to expand light rail. Right now, the plan is to bring light rail to Northgate in 2021 and Lynnwood and Redmond in 2023, and Ballard gets light rail in about 35 years. So that's the future. Believe it or not, though, this is not the first time Seattle planned and built rail transit. The head of the Museum of History and Industry, Leonard Garfield, told KUOW's Marcy Silman that in Seattle's infancy, business leaders were thinking about the fastest, easiest ways to move people and goods.
If we've got hills, let's get rid of them. If we've got water, let's figure out the fastest way to get across it. That really is what led to planning. It was economic expediency.
So they were looking for efficiency. You mentioned, let's get rid of them. Hills, were they, and water, were there particular focuses, foci, I guess is the word, for what they thought would be most rapid and most efficient?
Yes, and that's what we're in some ways still living with today. They believed in a centralized business district. You know, downtowns really were the creation of the late 19th and early 20th century, and Seattle had a great one. So it was getting people to and from that central core that really was the key, and then creating neighborhoods that were sufficiently far away to be comfortable and livable, but close enough to get to the downtown area.
Was there a mass transit system?
So that's really what the result was. It was our first mass transit system. It was our streetcar system. And it began in the early 20th century by the 1940s, the early 1940s, we had an extensive network. You could get anywhere in this city on streetcar. You could get downtown. You could make all kinds of connections. You could get as far away as Tacoma or as far north as Everett and beyond to Bellingham in really just a matter of hours without ever really having to change transportation systems.
All right, Leonard Garfield, you are speaking the dream for a zillion people listening. What happened?
Well, that's a good question. What did happen? I think we sometimes keep asking ourselves that. What happened was really the automobile. It was the rise of the car, the rise of privatized transit, the notion that not only did every American deserve a comfortable home and a job, but they also deserved an automobile. And when you give every household an automobile, suddenly you lose that density, you lose that importance of a central center, and you begin to lose the efficiency of a mass transit system.
So all these streetcar lines just became obsolete?
They really did. And by the early 1940s, really before World War II, the last streetcar was gone from service. They were literally scrapped and in some cases burned. We replaced them to some extent with a bus system, but it was a system that was much more fluid, far less centralized than the streetcar system had been.
So by the 40s, this stuff was all gone?
The last streetcar was really in the early 1940s.
That's amazing. I'm speaking with Leonard Garfield. He heads up Seattle's Museum of History and Industry. I know, Leonard, that in the 1960s and 1970s, some people did advocate reviving some sort of mass transit system. What happened to those efforts and why weren't they universally applauded and pushed forward?
Yeah, you'd think that a progressive community like Seattle would embrace mass transit. And in the 50s, in the 60s, even in the 1970s, there were ballot issues, many of them, that said, let's have a light rail system, let's have mass transit. They were routinely voted down by the voters. And the answer, Marcy, is the price tag. They were very, very expensive. And the compelling need for it really wasn't there in the voters' minds. They had a home, perhaps in a suburb. They had a workplace that maybe wouldn't be reached by these mass transit lines because the region was becoming much broader and less centralized. So it never was really a compelling sell. We simply didn't have either the density of a New York or a Chicago, but we also didn't have the voter will that saw mass transit as absolutely essential to the long-term quality of life.
So something like the monorail, which was built for the 1962 Century 21 fare, was that seen as transportation or was it some other kind of thing?
Well, I think it was seen as a prototype of what could be in the city of the future. Remember, it was Century 21 and right. It was happening 40 years before that was going to arrive. So in our fantasy of where we might end up, the monorail had a role. But would we build that monorail and extend it in the years right after the fair? The answer was absolutely no.
So there just was no will and there was, we flash forward 50 years from that fair, 53 years at this point as you and I talk. And when we look at the future, how can what happened in the past inform us?
Well, I think we have to look back at that early 20th century streetcar system. It led to a beautiful, thriving, vibrant downtown, and it led to what were called streetcar suburbs, essentially very coherent neighborhoods relatively close to the city center that allowed density. And whether that was Wallingford or Capitol Hill or the University District, they all were served by streetcar systems that provided quick access to your home and equally quick access downtown. It was a perfect recipe for a city that was increasing density. And I think that's the lesson we need to learn.
When I think of cities with centralized cores or at least centralized mass transit, London comes to mind. The London Tube system, it's underground, is one of those kind of systems that has a downtown hub with spokes mm-hmm. that lead out. It seems that Metro's buses are also organized in a similar way, that really the core is either Northgate or downtown Seattle and we're running lines out from there. Trains, that light rail trains that are under construction two blocks from where you and I sit, also have that same theme. Is that going to be enough to serve the region as it continues to balloon?
Well, I think in the 21st century, we have to consider several centralized hubs. Clearly, the East Side as well as downtown are hubs of commerce and density and so forth. So it may not be a single downtown with spokes going out to a series of neighborhoods. There may be several centers which are all tied into the same network. So that might be a little different than what we experienced 100 years ago. But I think the principle is still there. You want centralized cores and you want easy access to smaller neighborhoods where people actually live.
So, Leonard Garfield, you work at a history museum. You're not a transportation planner, but you wrote about this for Crosscut Online. Have the regional transportation planners picked up on what our ancestors in this region did and maybe could use that?
Oh, I think that history is definitely providing lessons for today's transit plans. Clearly, what we are building now is essentially replacing and expanding what we already had. So the one thing to remember, though, that is good is that the investments we made 100 years ago and 50 years ago, we're still reaping benefits in strong neighborhoods and a strong downtown. The investments we make today, they'll reap rewards 50, 100 years from now. We have to keep that long-term perspective in mind.
What do you think our transportation future looks like?
I think I join a lot of folks, and I hope that it will continue to be one that's dominated by mass transit rather than the individual automobile. I think it really has to be for a whole lot of reasons, economic, environmental, and really just quality of life.
Leonard Garfield, Executive Director of the Museum of History and Industry. And if you want to give public comment on Sound Transit's expansion plans, remember, they're taking your comment right now. So we are tweeting that link out now, at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. Have you ever heard a song that changed your life? Well, Bob Boylan has. He's host and creator of NPR's All Songs Considered. And he's not alone. Boylan interviewed dozens of musicians about what songs changed their lives. And he wrote about their answers in his new book. It's called, as you might expect, Your Song Changed My Life. Boylan told Jeannie Yandel the song that changed his life is A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
John Lennon said to George Martin, their producer, I want you to imagine the end of the world and make it so in music. And that's not the exact quote, but that's the essence of it. And George Martin grabbed an orchestra of about 40 people. He recorded them doing something what he imagined to be the end of the world, this climactic build. And then it recorded them again and again and again and then meshed them all together. And you have this like 160-piece string thing. And before that song, I'd never heard anything that sounded like it. But lyrically, there are two things that happen in that song. One is, there are two songs I think of as in a day in the life. John Lennon's song that opens up, I read the news today, oh boy.
I read the news today, oh boy. About a lucky man who made the grade.
That song is about a few things, but the one thing that strikes me, it's about the death of somebody killed in a car crash. That person was Tara Brown. Tara Brown was a heir to the Guinness fortune and a very rich socialite, very handsome young man. Died, gone, car crash.
Blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed.
Paul McCartney has another song within that song that he was working on that was, you know, woke up, fell out of bed.
Woke up, fell out of bed. Dragged a comb across my head. Found my way downstairs and drank a cup.
It was the mundane, everyday bit of life that we all go through and really just, for the most part, we are and can be very bored by. And it's just, oh, no, I got to do that again. But those two things juxtaposed, as the more I listened to that song, made me realize about the preciousness of life. And that even if you're just running to catch your bus or you're just waking up and you're running late, it's still pretty darn good to be alive.
Bob, why did you want to ask musicians that same question? What song changed their lives?
You know, I don't know about you, but whenever I talk to musicians simply about their own music, they can get tired of answering some of those same questions. But I've always noticed that whenever I ask a musician about someone else's music, they just light up, and it's really fun. And so I wanted to do something that a book that had stories that had a similar theme, but that told me a lot about who they were without them telling me directly about who they were. And it worked well. So I would do interviews with musicians, and then I would say, and then I'd look at the song they chose, look at the music they make, look at the artist who made the song that they chose, and just start to write an essay to connect all those little dots.
One of the musicians you talked to was Dave Grohl, who he's probably best known around here as the drummer of Nirvana. I think he did something else after Nirvana, but I'm not really sure what it is.
Yeah,
most importantly, right, doesn't, I don't know. But you talked with him and asked him what song changed his life. What did he tell you?
One day, he went to Chicago and visited his Aunt Sherry and his cousin Tracy. And Aunt Sherry said to Tracy, who was a real punk kid, hey, take Dave and down to the punk show tonight. and Tracy basically looked at Dave and thought he was going to get his bottom kicked. But Dave winds up in the front of the stage for this group called Naked Ray Gun. Winds up with the singer like on his head. The Dave describes the decibel level of the guitars at about 140 dB. And so he went back home and was really inspired to say to his, he was drumming and banging on his mattresses and pillows as a drummer in his basement, but he wanted to make music with his friends that wasn't someone else's music. And he came home and he said, we're going to make our own music, we're going to do this thing. They all looked at him like he was nuts, but we all know that Dave Grohl is not nuts. And he was inspired, and a really, really inspired man.
Dave Grohl wasn't the only musician you talked to. Obviously, you talked to 35 different musicians about what songs inspired them, what songs changed their lives. So what do you know now about inspiration that you didn't know before?
It can come at any time, but often comes during teen years. There is something that we are more susceptible. I think it has to do with hormones that makes us more susceptible to things that are emotionally charged. I think there needs to be a sense of to be ready for it. So, for example, this wasn't a song that changed his life, but Jimmy Page moves into a house. We know Jimmy Page, right? Got some guitar player dude. And he moves into a house with his family when he's like a 7 or 8-year-old kid. There's a guitar in the house. The only thing in the house, right? It's an empty house. But it wasn't until he saw a kid at school play the song that he had loved hearing on the radio. It was a song called Rock Island Line.
Oh, well, a Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. A Rock Island Line is a road to ride it. A Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like a fine. You get your ticket at the station on a Rock Island Line.
He saw a friend at school play this song on his friend's guitar. And Paige thought, I have one of those in my closet. And he went back home, got that guitar, had strings on it, went to school, and the kid taught him how to play Rock Island Line. And, the rest of the story we sort of know. But what I'm saying here is that there's a moment in time where things converge. Your emotions, everything is sort of ready for that moment of inspiration.
Bob Boylan, host and creator of NPR's All Songs Considered, telling Jeannie Andel about his new book, Your Song Changed My Life. KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. The question at hand right now on KUOW is, why type and click at your computer when you can just talk to it? Is that basically it?
That's the gist. We're seeing this rise of chatbot commerce.
Yes. Todd is here from the tech news site GeekWire, and tell us about, call it conversational commerce, call it chatbots. What are these things?
So these are either spoken words, so voice-activated assistants, or actually in many cases they work via text message or Facebook Messenger, for example. It's this just rapid rise that we've seen even just over the past couple months with Facebook, Microsoft, a number of startups, really allowing you to start buying things by conversing with an artificial intelligence agent. That is the gist.
Right. We'll talk about how Seattle is big into this in a moment. Are there humans behind the chatbot?
Yes and no. The default is that it is simply a computer reading your responses, hearing your voice and saying, okay, well, you want to buy those flowers or you want to book this hotel room. Here is what my program says I should respond to that inquiry. Mm-hmm. But in some cases, there are situations where humans then intervene and come in and say, okay, well, the chatbot itself is not actually working in this case. So you can sort of summon the sentient being.
But wait a minute. How does the human being get notified that the chatbot isn't figuring you out?
It depends on which service you're talking about. But basically, for example, there's a new startup called Reply Yes in Seattle that's trying this with records. You can buy records, good old-fashioned
vinyl, yeah.
Vinyl via text message. And they can tell when you're not responding with one of the preset instructions, yes, no, like, dislike. Uh-huh. When it starts to get more complex, their systems automatically alert a human agent to jump in on the conversation.
Got it. Somebody read up on what this human wants. Human, you speak human. Talk to the human for me.
Well, it's amazing because you start to see with the chatbots and with the human agents a real social connection happening. Microsoft had a service in China, and it's a research prototype called Xiao Ice. And so many people, they report, started saying to the chatbot that they loved the chatbot. I love you, Xiao Ice.
Oh, and there are movies about this?
Exactly. Yes, Her was in fact a movie. It is not simply fiction. This is something where people can develop a real relationship. And the gist in this trend is that the companies are hoping that relationship turns into sales.
Yes. Yeah, say more about why this is really an important innovation, a new chapter in commerce, in life.
You know, I'm actually not convinced that it's more than a fad at
this
point.
Okay, tell me about that.
There is the potential. These companies, several companies, Microsoft, Facebook, all these startups, they're making big bets on this. I think the jury is still out on this. I don't know that vast swaths of the population are going to be interested in buying via chat. It is, though, something where these tech companies are just making it is the trend right now. It is really something where these companies are just putting tons of effort behind it.
Well, I have just that app, or I guess ability on my phone to talk my emails or my texts.
Yes,
and I use it more and more. I use it when I can. I have actually ducked out of a room so that I can talk an email that I want to type. Typing becomes a pain. It's cumbersome. And so I don't know what I find it pretty sticky. What makes you think it's not the way to interact with your computer, to talk to it?
For commerce in particular, uh-huh. I think it's potentially a fad. Now, your experience is reinforced by Amazon's Alexa, the Echo smart speaker that is purely voice interaction, and it's taken off. Now, to take that a step further and to trust a bot, an artificial intelligent agent, to actually purchase something for you, I think that is one more leap, and I'm not sure that we're going to get there in the short term.
Okay. Now, will you tell us more? You mentioned this one Seattle company with the
yes.
vinyl records, Reply Yes. Say more about how Seattle is in on this fad / important chapter in life.
We have the roots, the ingredients for really the power of artificial intelligence. We have the software community, built up by Microsoft and startups over the years, and we have this burgeoning artificial intelligence community, Paul Allen's Artificial Intelligence Institute and people coming out of the University of Washington. Really, we're seeing it come together here with all of the different ingredients that we have in this tech ecosystem in Seattle.
So we've talked about whether this is important or whether chatbots are a fad. Do you see any downsides? What if it's important and worrisome?
Well, there is the potential here, at least, for people to make purchases that they might not otherwise make. There is also just the question of human connection and whether we should have you know, actual real interactions with real people on the other end of a line. You know, it's hard to make that argument with commerce, because you could argue that it's already been, you know, somewhat spoiled. It's not a real interaction. It's a commercial interaction. But, you know, there is the chance that so many more of our interactions will be with machines, not only through machines, but with machines. And I think there are bigger questions for society when that happens.
You know, I also have heard Amazon's Alexa app, this is their Echo machine, it has the name Alexa, and you talk to it, criticized because you ask a question and Alexa is set up to give you Wikipedia's answer.
Right.
But when you, if you actually do the work to go online, you start to get a sense of what you can trust and what you can't. But if Alexa just says it like it's gospel, you're shrinking your world.
And the other example, I mentioned the Microsoft artificial intelligence test in China. There was one here in the U.S. called Tay.ai. This is the one that the internet within 24 hours taught to be, you know, racist, misogynistic, and it was taken offline. So there are big risks here for companies that go this direction, because you're turning over the intelligence to the machine and letting it go. I mean, that is what artificial intelligence is about, and there's a risk there.
You could argue that was depressing, or that it's kind of hopeful that human beings are just mocking this computer out of existence and showing our fire a little bit.
That's right. The bar is high, at least for intellect on the internet, I guess, potentially.
Right. You're not going to get us that easy, computers. We've been talking with Todd Bishop from the tech news site GeekWire about chatbots. It's always good to talk with you, Todd. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
On KUOW's The Record, we're live tweeting. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, helping you interface with us, as they say, at KUOW. Producer Jason Pagano, engineer Bernard Ouellette. I'm Bill Radkeep. Always good to have you.